Welcome to Overtime, Shoots and Scores, a Centennial College Sports Radio Show. We talk about anything but football. So let's get the ball rolling right here, right now.
Welcome to the fourth session of Overtime. I'm Katie Lamb.
And I'm Kevin Campbell.
And on today's show, we've got quite a mixed bag. We've got Bob Elliott talking. Kevin's going to talk to a concussion and hockey specialist later on.
University of Waterloo professor Pat Bishop. He'll talk about concussions and fighting in hockey.
And I think we've got a little bit of a fun Twitter segment planned, too. Maybe Kevin will talk a little bit more about that later as well.
So our producer, Ryan Horn, will do a little rapid-fire segment. He'll give us some tweets, and we'll have to guess who tweeted those. So that'll finish off the show for you on week four of Overtime.
Cool.
So what was going on this week, Katie, in the world of sports?
Well, as you know, baseball playoffs got started off last night.
They did.
Pirates were trounced by Cincinnati 9-1. A.J. Burnett, former Blue Jay, was terrible. He only went 2-plus innings and failed to score a strikeout.
A.J. Burnett.
I know, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah.
And Carlos Beltran, he's hit a 422-foot home run last night and tied Babe Ruth's postseason home run record, so that was kind of special.
That's pretty significant, isn't it? Like career home runs in the postseason?
Yeah, apparently this is when Beltran shines, is in the postseason.
Yeah, and those playoff performers.
So I don't know if he can be compared to the Babe Ruth yet, but I know it's pretty must be pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good record to, I mean, even be mentioned in the same breath as Babe Ruth. So.
And he's hit them in less games than Babe Ruth did. Babe Ruth was like 53 games. It took him to get 18 home runs, and Beltran was like 41 games. So.
Oh, wow. So he can eclipse them in this year, I guess.
Certainly. And Dodgers beat the Braves last night 6-1. Clayton Kershaw pitched pretty solidly. So that's kind of a baseball wrap-up. What else we got?
So we'll talk more about baseball with Bob Elliott when he comes on the show. President's Cup action, some golf for you. Graham DeLate, the Canadian, is playing with Jason Day. And they will go up against Phil Mickelson and another American.
Brant Snedeker.
And the U.S. leads the international team 3.5 points to 2.5. based on three wins by the States, two wins by the international team, and a tie between Haas and Simpson and Scott and Matsuyama.
Seems like DeLatte is really shining here. Yesterday, him and Day beat Hunter Mahan and Brant Snedeker, and then today they'll be squaring off against Keegan Bradley and Phil Mickelson, so that is something to look forward to. Those are pretty solid players.
That'll be interesting to watch. And then on Sunday, the singles will commence 12 singles matches one-on-one. So that'll be interesting to see them without the partner, kind of see how they do. Today should be pretty fun. I mean, Mickelson and DeLate, just it's probably like a measuring stick to see how DeLate can compare to, you know, a world-renowned golfer.
Who would have thunk it? From Weyburn, Saskatchewan, producing a golfer that could, you know, test his mettle against Phil Mickelson.
Exactly, yeah. You can probably count on two hands how many noteworthy Saskatchewan
athletes of any type.
Alternative sport players, yeah. Let alone like hockey or anything.
Cool.
So good.
Sorry?
Just good for Graham DeLate, and, you know, we'll see how he does.
For sure. And there's some tennis action Milos was...
Yeah, Milos made
competing.
It...
The Japan Cup.
Japan Open semifinals. And Juan Del Potro is also in those. He's the other notable name. And a Spaniard, Almagro, is also in the semis, as is Dodig. So no Nadal. I mean, Nadal probably sat this one out, as well as Djokovic. They're not playing in this one. But Raonic recently won the Thailand Open, so you know there's the talk with him and the winning the smaller tournaments, but you know on the big stage he kind of falters. What do you think contributes to that?
Well, I don't know. He's still quite young, right? He's only 22, and it's you know, it takes a long time to kind of get to those levels. I think players like Nadal and Federer and Djokovic, they're just the elite of the, you know, they're just the cream of the crop. They're, you know, they're sort of untouchable, right? So mm-hmm. it's hard to, you know, when you've got those three guys all kind of sitting at the top, it's hard to kind of break that threshold. And mm-hmm. I think you just have to, like, let Milos come into his, you know, come into his own, and it, you know, eventually he probably will get there. I mean, he did beat Thomas Berdych to win the tournament in Thailand. So mm-hmm. He's getting there, just slowly but surely. And I think we can't lose faith in him right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's 22, and some people are saying, you know, he's kind of hit his peak. He's never really going to get better. But I mean, all players evolve. I mean, it's never really static with one player or the other. And he's still got room to grow. I mean, I think, you know, men peak with their athletic performance around the age of 27, I think, is the stat. So he's got, you know, 5 years, even though Nadal at age 22 was a little, you know, accomplishing a little more than Raonic. But to compare yourself to one of the greatest players
ever, like...
Yeah, ever. Yeah, let alone playing right now, but ever. It's a little much, but, you know, he's number 11 ranked right now, and we'll see what else is in store for him. Maybe it's a nerves thing. The Grand Slams do, you know, bring out the best and the worst of some people. But he's got enough experience now that he's played in them enough. He's gotten some rounds under his belt. And he's also he's faced greatness. He faced Nadal in the Canadian Open in the finals, so he knows what it takes. So we'll just see if he can get there.
Exactly. And Bills played last night. What happened there?
The Bills played the Browns, two kind of surprising teams. The Bills being 1-3 and the Bills being 2-2 and the Browns being 1-3. Producer's telling us Browns are 2-2. 3-2.
That's what they are now, though, right?
Yeah, they're now 3-2, but they were 2-2 before heading into this game. And both having young quarterbacks doing some things. The Browns quarterback, Brandon Whedon, losing the first two games for Cleveland. Not much was coming out of Whedon's performance. And then Brian Hoyer comes in, starts this game against Buffalo. Hoyer injures his knee, and then Whedon, on a kind of reclamation act, plays extremely well, beats Buffalo 37-24, but Buffalo also loses their young quarterback. And it's kind of a sad story for teams that weren't expected to do much. For the young quarterbacks to get injured, it's kind of cruel in a way. I mean, yeah. Cleveland and Buffalo, you know, the afterthoughts of the NFL, essentially, doing some great things, and then, you know, injuries start to pile up. But that happens to every team, and, you know, an opportunity. It's just an opportunity for someone else. So maybe Whedon can take this and move forward with Cleveland with week six. So that was the Thursday night game. The NFL's, it's kind of weird to have an NFL game on a Thursday night. How did, I'm not sure how it was, the audience took it in. I'm not sure if how many people knew about it, Buffalo and Cleveland, like in the rest of the United States, but.
Well, especially when it was game one of NL, like the baseball playoffs and things like that, they had a lot to compete with,
for
right?
Sure. Oh, yeah, the day one of the MLB playoffs is no small thing. So I think, yeah. It was just kind of a weird game to watch, I think, with two of
the kind of underdogs of
the surprising teams going against each other on an off night.
I don't know. Some marketing machine thought this was a good idea, I guess, somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't.
Yeah. So that was the NFL on a Thursday night.
Switching back to baseball, this just in. I'm seeing this on my computer. Alex Rodriguez has sued MLB. So
this is huge.
It says Alex Rodriguez is suing Major League Baseball, accusing the league of interfering with his contracts and business relationships. This obviously has to do with his 211 game suspension that the MLB brought down on him for his alleged use of
performance-enhancing drugs,
PEDs. So, and which has really created a boondoggle for him. You know, his name is tarnished. He can't play. This is a lot. And, you know, with MLB Commissioner Bud Selig on his way out, I mean, this could be his legacy. I mean, it's insane. What do you think?
Yeah, he appealed, which was the first kind of sign that he wouldn't go down quietly, even if these allegations are true or not. So he can continue to play. Whether the Yankees wanted him there or not is another story. Suing the MLB is, it's been done before, but both sides have, incredible, law lawyer power behind them. MLB, they absolutely want this guy out of their league. If they didn't before, now they do. To sue the league that you're playing in is
huge.
Exactly. And the 211 game suspension was, that probably ticked him off a little bit just because of the precedents that were set with other players. No one's gotten a 211 game suspension, and that was the remainder of this season and all of next season. But we'll see how this plays out. I think it's gonna get nasty before it gets better for any side. But it'll be a story to watch for. It'll be all over the news. I think A-Rod is kind of a magnet for headline stories. So we'll see how that plays out. But this just came up on, I think, half an hour ago that this dropped.
Yeah. So we'll be following that as the weeks come. But as you said, there's a lot of money behind both the Alex Rodriguez camp, and MLB, and there's a lot at stake. So it'll be a really interesting story to see how it all unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, the 2011 NL MVP Ryan Braun, I mean, he took his punishment, quietly. He missed the season's 65 games, so there's two different sides of how you can take this, and A-Rod seems to be going the Lance Armstrong.
He's like, I'm not going to be made an example of. You're not going to embarrass me.
Yeah.
It's going to be an ego. It's going to be a test of egos too, right? It's a stand up. Who's going to go? Who's going to blink first?
Bud Selig and A-Rod. I mean, I don't think there's a room that can hold those guys' heads, let alone the rest of their bodies. But that'll be fun to watch if nothing else. Mm. Some NHL action from last night. Calgary came into Washington. TSN chose to show this on a Thursday night. And no one thought really Calgary was ever going to do anything. How many legitimate NHL players are on their team is even, up for debate. But they got out to a 4-1 lead against Washington, one of the most offensive, Alex Ovechkin, Nicholas Backstrom. This top line is absolutely incredible. They picked up Mikhail Grabowski, who we'll touch on later. Offensive dynamos, but it seems their goaltender, Braden Holtby, the young guy who took this league by storm in the playoffs a couple of years ago, just couldn't keep the puck out of the net, and he let in, three goals in the first period. And Washington seemed to just be reeling from arguably the worst team in the league. But and all credit to Calgary to come in and to achieve this. It was all the rookies that were making all the noise, and Kerry Ramo taking over for Mika Kiprusoff, the retired longtime Flame. No one really knew what to expect from him playing in Europe, but he held his own until the third period. Calgary kind of you know, I'm not sure if they collapsed or if Alex Ovechkin himself is a one-man show, and he almost put the whole team on his back like he always does and tied the game 4-4. Went to overtime, went to a shootout, and this is kind of a nice segue into Mikhail Grabowski. Grabowski gets the first goal in the shootout, and it's almost over. Calgary doesn't ever score in the shootout, and the Caps come, you know, win the comeback 5-4 in overtime. We'll be right back with some more overtime, and Bob Elliott is coming up on the show. Welcome back to Overtime, and we are here with Cooperstown Hall of Famer Bob Elliott of the Canadian Baseball Network.
Hey,
Bob.
Hey.
Hi, it's Katie Lamb calling.
How you doing, Katie?
Good, how are you?
Real good.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah, there was announcements on a loudspeaker in the press box, so now I'm outside.
Okay. All right, well, sounds good. So last night, Pirates were trounced by Cincinnati, and A.J. Burnett was terrible. What did you see?
When things go bad for A.J. Burnett, they go bad very, very quickly. He walked the pitcher, which he should never do. That's a cardinal sin, and especially they know if an inning. And, you know, he should be licking his chops. He should, I got an easy one to start the inning, and then a base hit, and then he went to 2-1 on Beltran. That was a 3-run homer, and then he just went to pieces after that. He was, he walked a couple of guys, including one with a bases loaded. He hit a guy in the foot, and then there was that freak play down the first baseline, which, as Hurdle said, 2 feet the other way, maybe it's a double play, except it wasn't. There was two more runs, and then the throw in from right field hit the runner on first and kicked towards the dugout, and another run scored. So it was a disaster for the Pirates.
And I mean, what is your kind of lookout? What's the lookout for the Pirates? I mean, can they bounce back, or what do you think? How do you think they're going
to
fare?
Well, they've got a guy going today, a young guy, UCLA number one pick overall, Garrett Cole, who I have not seen him. I mean, everybody raves about him. This is a tough stage. This is a loud crowd, and everybody's dressed in Cardinal red or Cardinal, whatever. And it could be intimidating, and he had some struggles in the first inning. I think if he gets through the first inning, they could be all right. They need the Pirates need to win here, because it's going to be tough to if that's a 5-series to go home down 2-0. I mean, the Giants survived last year after losing the first two to the Reds last year, but it's an awful hill to climb when you go down 2-0.
Mm-hmm. And what about AJ? He might be back for game 5, and I mean, he's got a terrible record at Busch Stadium. So, I mean, what do the Pirates think? How is he going to bounce back?
Well, I don't think they have any other options, but we were just asking Hurdle about game 5, and he said, I'm worried about game 2, which is the attitude you have to take. You can't put the cart, or in Burnett's case, the horse in front of the, you know, you gotta win one before you even think about that. You gotta worry about this game, and then, he threw so few pitches, there's talk that they could pitch him on game 4 in Pittsburgh if they got that far.
Mm-hmm.
But that would, I don't know if that would bring Cole for back here. I guess that would depend on how he did today.
Cool. And looking at tonight, Max Scherzer's pitching instead of Verlander. What do you think about that?
I think he was their guy for the season. You know, I think he's probably the Cy Young Award winner. I think knowing Leland, he would probably look at it and have a sound reason for it, for as to why, who goes first or something. But he was the best guy this year. Like
Right. And the other AL matchup is Matt Moore versus John Lester. And Matt Moore's got a pretty good record against Boston, but John Lester's been their ace. How do you think that matchup's going to go down?
Well, I think I would say by all rights, Red Sox win for fun. But I mean, Tampa Bay was a week ago at the Sky Dome or the Rogers Center. They looked in serious trouble, and they battled back and they won. They hung on rather after scoring a bunch in the first inning. And they beat the Blue Jays, and then they had to win in Texas, and they won that game at the tiebreaker, and then they went to Cleveland, and they won there. So, they packed for where they went. They went to New York before Toronto, so they packed for a week, and they still haven't been home, you know. So I think they're it's Joe Madden and the Band of Merry Men who've climbed every hill that they've been assigned to take, and they've done it. So I give them a lot of credit, that team, and the third baseman Longoria he always seems to have a knack to arise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. They don't have a lot of hitting, but they got pretty good pitching.
For sure. So it's going to be a battle of momentum versus momentum with the Rays and rest for the Red Sox. I think it's might come down to. I don't know. What do you think?
The Red Sox haven't played in a while, and this is I guess the last series to get going. I guess Oakland and Detroit would be because of the time difference or whatever, but I'm not sure who starts later. But yeah, it's that old line, like when you're going good, you want to play every day, and that's what the Rays have been doing. And when you're, it takes a little while to get the thing to kick, for the button to click in again in the postseason. If you had that much time off, the Red Sox haven't played a meaningful game in quite a while. But I think it all depends on the pitcher, and if the Red Sox starter is fine, the Red Sox will be fine. And I think it'll be the Red Sox.
The Red Sox. Do you think the Red Sox will go all the way? Or do you think we'll see them hoisting the World Series?
No, I think it'll be Troy and the Dodgers. I think my pick, I think before it started was Atlanta, but I don't think that's going to happen now. They're like the best franchise in baseball from opening day till the end of the season, and they just scuffle in the postseason.
All right. Well, I'm going to pass you over to my co-host Kevin. He might have some more questions.
Hi, Bob. It's Kevin here. How's it going?
Excellent, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. I just had a question about a recent Jays signee, Andrew Case, made his appearance at Tournament 12. What did he do that made the Jays like him so much?
I'm sorry. They cranked up the music there. I heard you mention Andrew Case, and then I didn't hear what you said after that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Just what did he do at Tournament 12 to make the Jays like him so much?
What did he do? Well, he pitched two innings in the opening game for the Maritimes and two hitless innings. He had six strikeouts, and then he pitched a no-hitter in the semifinal. And I think he pitched nine innings with 19 strikeouts, and he sat at 92 comfortably. He's not a big guy, but the great thing about him was he was throwing as hard in the later innings as he was in the early innings. Like a lot of guys, there was a couple of kids there that were 86, 88 first inning, and people were excited, and then the next second inning they come out and they were 81.
Right.
Well, he was able to maintain it, and he's older than the high school kids, but he's in his second year at the Prairie Baseball Academy in Lethbridge. But some people say, well, he's older. Well, a college draft is 21. This kid is 20, I think. So it's not like somebody said he's not 48 or something.
Yeah. Is it common for someone from New Brunswick to go over and play baseball and you know across the country in Lethbridge, or is that a unique case?
No, I would say it would be. It's quite common now. I think they have that Vauxhall Academy has had about six guys on a team that's in southern Alberta, and the Prospects Academy. I think it's in either in St. Albert or Red Deer near Edmonton. There, I think somewhere. They had the catcher was from there, and then they had about four guys at the Prairie Baseball Academy. So what they do, I remember when it started, when Vauxhall was the first academy, when it started, he said, we're not going after any of the BC kids or the Ontario kids or the Quebec kids because they've got the programs are so good.
Right.
But we think we can recruit from the Prairies and from the Maritimes, and that's what they've done. And they've had some real good ones come out of there and do well. He runs Les McTavish, and Vauxhall runs a very good program.
Yeah, Vauxhall had quite a few players come out to Tournament 12, including, you know, pitcher Ben Onishko, who also in about two innings put his name, you know, with the best of them.
Yeah, he'll probably be a draft this year. Yeah, he's a Winnipeg kid, and, you know, I don't know if he'd have got that same opportunity. I mean, you can't say players don't come from the Maritimes because you got Matt Stairs, you got Rael Cormier, and you got Jason Dixon. But this gives them a little bit more foundation, and it lets them catch up to say the other provinces that have a heavier schedules. Like there's some Ontario teams that'll play 60, 70 games. Well, that doesn't happen in the Maritimes.
Right. What do the just on the technical side? What do the Jays? To be able to sign a player like Andrew Case, do they only have a limited number of these kind of signings they can do every year?
No, they have a limited amount of budget for the first 10 picks. Oh. You can't go above it, or it's there's a tax if you go 5% above.
Okay.
And this year they didn't get there, but a year ago there, I think they paid $80,000 in tax. But on a free agent like this, it was anybody could sign him. It's like the old days before 1965.
Yeah.
It's first man in gets to sign him. Oakland was in on him, and so was Milwaukee. So he opened some eyes. Good for him.
Okay. Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. I'm going to pass you off to Katie. Thanks for this.
All right. Thank you.
So I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add about upcoming weekend in baseball. You know what you're looking forward to, and what we might see.
Well, if I knew, Katie, what was really going to happen, I would be
a rich man
in Vegas with my feet up, just ready to cash my tickets. But I think this is the best. You know, the World Series is really good, and the Championship Series is good. But a day like today, you got four games and with so much on the line. It's it's a nice early start here and everything, so you can take your time. But everybody wants to write to get to a restaurant to see the next game. You know, it's
a marathon.
So you don't want to miss something. So like if the winner that you're covering in the next round or whatever, you don't want to miss a play or something. So it's kind of like this is comparable to March Madness, I guess, the early round, you know, where there's so many games all at once. It's not at that, what do they play, 36 games or whatever. I don't know. I'm not a basketball guy, but 32 games or whatever. But it's a day full of baseball, and it's going to be tomorrow's the off day here, but there'll be three games tomorrow, I guess.
Right.
So it's fun filled for a dope like myself.
Fun filled, but maybe
baseball junkie.
But maybe some sleepless nights, or some, you know, at least early mornings and late nights for you.
Yeah, I can handle the late nights. It's early mornings that give me a problem.
Well, you got a game starts at 1, you said.
Yes.
And
1 year time, yeah.
One hour time. So we probably should let you get busy and get scribbling some notes and chasing down some players and managers and stuff like that. So thank you for talking to us. And
thank you both very much.
Bob Elliott from the Toronto Sun and the Canadian Baseball Network. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to our third segment of our fourth edition of Overtime. We're going to switch gears a little bit after talking to the very erudite Bob Elliott. I mean, he's amazing how much he knows about baseball. We're going to switch gears to things that baffle me a little bit, and that would be the Toronto Maple Leafs, Colt Knorr, George Parros fight, and silly things that the Toronto Maple Leafs have done. Kevin, did you watch the opening game?
I did.
Tuesday night.
Yep.
It was
a terrific game, tremendous game up until the third period where I don't know who was trying to get momentum. Montreal was trying to come back against the Toronto lead. George Parros was out there with Colt Knorr, and anytime those two guys are out there, you know, stuff happens. They're the two enforcers, quote unquote, of their teams. One can argue, you know, goons.
That's what I call them. Goons.
Yeah, yeah. It's a term that's thrown out there. I mean, George Parros is I believe he's a Princeton grad, economics. But you know, he can't skate or play or, you know, dangle the puck as well as some other people. So he's, you know, demoted to the fourth line, as is Colt Knorr. And, you know, lo and behold, these two guys hook up for a fight in the third period. And it's going, you know, like fights go. But Colt Knorr loses an edge. He falls. He grabs. He's got his arm on Parros' sweater. So Parros goes down with him. And Parros' other arm is tied up, you know, somewhere in a jersey. So he has no way of protecting his face. I think we've all seen it by now, and he falls flat on his face on the ice. His helmet doesn't really do anything in this case because he fell on his chin. And he's knocked out cold for about 10 seconds, and he comes back with smelling salts and whatever. And this ignites over Twitter, over Facebook, over the media. Should fighting be allowed in the 2013 edition of the National Hockey League? And it's a debate that's raged on for years before this. It will for years after this. But this is, you know, a spark plug that just ignited an intense debate over fighting's place in hockey.
Well, I know, like, a lot of GMs have come out. Steve Yzerman went on Twitter, and he was like, we need to end this now. This is fighting, and shots to the head, I think, is what is the sticking point, is what is the the real burning issue. It's, you know, it's arcane. We know the consequences. I mean, nobody needs to be told about Derek Boogaard and what happened there. And, you know, when we witnessed it for ourselves on Tuesday night, I mean, there's nothing more stunning or arresting than seeing George Parros laying flat out on the ice, motionless.
Yeah,
and they showed his parents. I was at a bar, but they did show two people standing there, just white-faced, ghost, you know, just absolutely in shock, watching, I think it was their son. I don't know if it was their parents, but it was looked like it could have been their parents, watching their son lay lifeless on the ice. And, you know, I mean, when's this madness going to end?
Does someone have to die?
Someone did die. Derek Boogaard died.
Right, but not, but not from a fight on, like, one fight on the ice.
No.
Three, Rick Rippon, Derek Boogaard, and Wade Bielak have died, and there's, you know, significant evidence linking hits to the brain and depression, that can link that. But does someone have to die on the ice for this to change? Is the question. And as you mentioned, Steve Yzerman, the general manager of the Tampa Bay Lightning, spoke out with this, as did three other general managers: the Chicago Blackhawks, Stan Bowman; the Carolina Hurricanes, Jim Rutherford, And one other who is not on the top of my mind right now, but there have been four that have said, I would be okay with a fightingless league. And that's pretty significant for general managers to say this, because they have an upcoming general managers meeting in November. And this will almost certainly be on the agenda.
Shiro was the other one.
Ray Shiro. Yeah. Right. Thank you. Pittsburgh Penguins, Ray Shiro. And it's kind of funny. All those teams, Pittsburgh Penguins, Hurricanes, Lightning, and Blackhawks, haven't been known to be the rough and tumble teams, like the Boston Bruins or the Toronto Maple Leafs. Mm-hmm. So it's not completely out of the ordinary that they would say that, but I think it gets the discussion going. And Dave Nonis went on TSN before Wednesday night's game against the Flyers, and he said, you know, I think it's an established tradition in the NHL. I don't think you can get rid of it. I think it helps police the game, which is another argument, because if you don't have fighting, then your star players are going to be vulnerable,
right?
Because these aggressors know there's no repercussions if their stick happens to come up to the face of these star players, or if they check them into the boards, and maybe, oh, like, I'll get a 5-minute penalty and that's it. I mean, there's no player policing, if you will.
But there's as a personal anecdote, as I was talking about to you before the show, I watched the third period at a bar here on the Danforth. And when George Parros went down, we're in Toronto, there was a lot of Toronto fans, and Toronto fans, a bunch of young kids, were cheering and making fun of George Parros as he laid there on the ice. And all I could think about was just how pathetic that was. And my friend, who's not a hockey fan, she was like, this is awful, this is cruel. You know, just making fun of somebody who's like, could be ostensibly really hurt or never play hockey again. I mean, the way he fell almost looked like his neck snapped back too. You know, when you fall on your chin,
yep.
It could have been a grave neck injury. But it kind of speaks to that fights, people like watching fights. I mean, people love that Colton Orr goes out fists flying every time he hits the ice, and that must be something that rides on general managers' minds and team owners' minds, that I will sell tickets if there's fights. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's a conundrum. The bottom line or player safety is something that...
Yeah, that's a huge issue with two equal sides, you know, selling tickets or maintaining player safety. And I think it's not an easy question to answer. You know, with that anecdote in the bars and everyone's going crazy over this fight and the result of this fight, which kind of, you know, makes everyone a little sick to their stomach. All I can attest to is I was at home, so I just saw what the arena was seeing. And the arena was pretty dang...
Well, they were in Montreal,
quiet.
Too, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And that even... Okay, I mean, it's a Montreal player that went down.
Right.
But I think, and Montreal is known as the loudest building in the NHL, one of the most fun to be there, well, like to be a part of. And for that building to essentially just, you can hear a pin drop in, that's something that's pretty significant. And I don't think anybody was really kind of riled up in that arena. I can't say to bars, obviously, but I think it also has to do with demographics and where that team is. Like, I think if it's in... Maybe the United States needs a little more incentive to watch hockey just because it's not as ingrained in their culture as much,
mm-hmm.
whereas it is in Canada. And maybe they like the fight. So, you know, that'll be a discussion up for debate. But
it's a discussion as old as time, it feels like.
Oh, yeah. It never goes away. And people on Twitter get tired of it, but it's something that needs to be talked about. So I'm sure it's run its course this week, and it'll be up on the agenda again in November when the GMs meet. And that'll be an interesting thing to see what comes out of that. But we're going to take a break. And UW's own Professor Emeritus Pat Bishop, who specializes in concussions, will be talking with me. And we'll have that interview coming up for you soon. So for Katie Land, this is Kevin Campbell. And we'll be right back.
So I guess in light of the Colton Orr and George Parros fight that occurred on, you know, the opening day of the NHL season, in your opinion, you know, has the NHL done enough to prevent head injuries and concussions over the past few years? They brought in, you know, the no taking off the helmet rule, the visor rule for all incoming players is mandatory. But it seems like people are still clamoring for more to be done. Do you think they've done enough?
Well, the biggest issue with respect to concussions is hitting each other above the head. And the NHL has instituted rules against head hits and head checking. And that's probably the biggest thing that that they've been able to do with respect to with respect to concussion.
Right.
Are they serious about head injuries? I think by and large they are serious about them and they're concerned about them. Are they doing enough? Probably not until they do something to reduce the frequency of fighting. And my own personal opinion is that fighting in the NHL is not something that's required, but it's something that goes on and it's allowed to go on and allowed to persist.
Right.
There's two problems with fighting. One is that you can when a player leaves the helmet on in a fight, that's fine, and they, you know, there's these enforcers who aren't wearing visors and so on because it's a grandfathered rule. The risk there in a fight with your helmet on is a blow to the jaw, like the knockout punch that knocks somebody out.
Right.
Or in the case of, Peros, where he fell over Orr and smacked his face with no visor on. He did have his helmet on, smacked his face into the ice. The other risk, of course, is if you take your helmet off, and now the risk there is not so much concussion concern for me as it is, a traumatic brain injury or a traumatic head injury,
right,
such as a subdural hematoma, fractured skull, and these things are lethal.
Right.
They lead to death, as in the case of a player in senior hockey a few years ago who, in a fight, lost his helmet and struck his head on the ice and died as a result. So until the NHL gets serious about more severe penalties, I guess, for fighting. I coached hockey in the Intercollegiate League when I was assistant at Laurier for 5 years. That's a league that doesn't allow fighting.
Yeah.
If you do fight, it's a automatic game misconduct. And, the potential for suspension as well. So we didn't have fights. Now, sometimes it's hard for the referee to differentiate between a fight and roughing, and quite often you would see 4 minutes each for roughing while they were, dancing around, holding onto each other's sweaters and so on. But we didn't see very many full-fledged punch-ups.
Right. One of the arguments for keeping fighting in the league is that it allows kind of player policing where, the star players aren't abused as much. And there's anecdotal evidence to suggest from the KHL and, I guess, leagues overseas that the sticks come up a little higher to the face area. The star players are kind of taken advantage of and kind of abuse a little more, but as you mentioned in the OUA, fighting, it's just as good as hockey is in the OHL, where I think they have a rule where you can only fight 10 times in one season, and if you fight any more, then you get a two-game suspension. But do you see the NHL kind of adopting an evolving policy in minimizing the number of fights in a game, or maybe taking the same kind of measures?
Well, it would be nice to see. I know that you know, the policing, the self-policing argument has been in effect for years. I think most guys can take care of themselves that play the game.
Right.
You don't want to see the superstars having to defend themselves all the time, but I think the notion that you need fighting to protect those kinds of players is silly. I know that the experience I had in the OUA was that the star players didn't get into fights because nobody was going to fight anyway. If you fought, you got a game ejection. So, the other notion that one of the goons will go after the good players to get them in a fight and get the good player ejected, well, that just didn't happen.
Right.
And, referees have got brains, too, you know. They can use common sense to know what who's instigating what and what's actually going on out there.
Right.
Let the referees police some of it. But I think the thing that Eisenman has called for, and I'm sure others, that there be a game misconduct. I think if you gradually go to that, adopt that policy, that the number of fights in hockey will greatly be reduced.
Right.
You don't see fighting in the playoffs. Teams can't afford to be 5 minutes down. They can't afford to be playing 5-on-5 for 5 minutes. So they don't fight. I mean, they know what goes and what doesn't, and fighting's down in playoffs. It's not something that needs to be policed.
Okay.
The game at that level. So
yeah. Why has concussions and head related injuries become so prevalent in the public perception of injuries in general? Is it because in the new post lockout rules, the clutching and holding aren't allowed anymore, so defensemen are left to essentially just hit, and sometimes they do it against the boards and when the player is a little more vulnerable. And as we saw with, I think, Ben Finelli, he was charged from, the opposing player coming from across the ice. And is it both, the change of rules and new evidence that's come out that suggests that concussions have a much more lingering effect than what was originally thought?
Well, I don't think the change of rules had anything to do with it. It made the game faster, and as a result, when players are able to skate faster, obviously they can hit harder. But I think the lack of respect of players for each other and for the head is the real problem. I think in the hockey's always had concussions. I don't think they've been recognized as much as they are now. There's much more awareness of the injury. The old notion that a player got his bell rung and was out for half period or something and came back to play. Well, we don't allow that anymore. It's just a better awareness of the fact that it is a brain injury. And because you can't see your brain doesn't mean it isn't injured.
Yeah.
You know, you can't see your heart, and you can tell when that's injured.
Yeah.
You can tell when your brain's injured. So, but the other thing is, I think the connection between you know, long-lasting effects, the post-traumatic sequelae, that they call it.
Welcome back to Overtime, and with just a couple minutes left, we'll discuss what we're up to this weekend. Katie, you got anything going on?
Oh yeah, it's a big weekend in horse racing, and as everyone knows,
that's your beat.
That's my beat. That's my love. On Saturday, Keeneland, Kentucky, Wise Dan, who's the horse of the year last year, North American horse of the year, he'll put his 9-race winning streak on the line. In the Shadwell Turf Mile, which is really exciting. We saw Wise Dan here in Toronto last month for the Woodbine Mile, where he basically got paid $600,000 to jog around the track because he's so awesome.
Nice.
And over in France, it's the Arc de Triomphe, which is a huge race. It's amazing. It's one of those things like on my top of my bucket list I'd like to go to. And fun fact, Wayne Gretzky has won when he had race horses with Bruce McNall. He won the Arc de Triomphe twice.
Wow.
So that's kind of a cool fun fact. So that's going on. It's Europe's one of Europe's biggest races, and I will be watching with bated breath. Mm-hmm. So what about you? What you got going on?
I'm heading back to Kitchener and seeing my dad, and I got season tickets for the Kitchener Rangers, which is as close as to professional hockey as you can get in Kitchener. but they host the Sarnia Sting tonight, and their backup goalie, Jack Moylan, will start. And they recently got Ben Thompson back from the New Jersey Devils. They sent him back from their farm team. So that's a boost to them. And they have Radek Faksa, who got back from Dallas Stars camp. He's on fire. He had 3 goals last game. Hat trick. And we'll see what they can do. For overtime.
So obviously also baseball playoffs and hockey and all kinds of things like that.
Oh, yeah, on TV. Yep, we'll be glued to the TV. It's the best time of year, I think, for a sports fan. You know, baseball playoffs, hockey starting up. I think October's always been that way. Football's going. Basketball starting soon. We'll have our eye on the TV. And that's it for segment 4 of Overtime. I'm Kevin Campbell.
I'm Katie Lim. See you next week.
See you.